Hello and welcome to Escape from Lockdown, the show all about how we got into this mess and how we got out of it. Now, my next guest is someone who I've admired for a very long time. I've been very keen to have him on because throughout this crisis, many thinkers have rationalised their opinions as scientific when they are, in fact, in my opinion, political. However, after reading my guest's output on Twitter or in his articles, such a claim could never be applied to him. He's always pursued this problem courageously, even if it means unpalatable conclusions. He is an economist, a writer and game theorist, director of Europe Economics. You may have read him in The Telegraph, or you might remember him from being the lead economist for the official Leave campaign, Vote Leave. He is, of course, the brilliant Andrew Lidico. Andrew, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, you're most welcome.
So, as I said in my intro there, I was just very keen to have you on because you've always been someone that I've turned to on Twitter to get their opinion, because it's always from a basis, you approach this problem from a basis of fundamental principles. So with that said, I'd like to go back to the beginning. Did you initially support the lockdown? And if so, why?
So I would have been willing to go along with most things that the government proposed at the time in the middle of March. Or I thought that it was quite a serious crisis. I was, I think I said fairly early on in the early part of February, when quite a lot of people were saying this won't come to amount to anything. Well, pandemics do happen, and we shouldn't assume that they couldn't happen to us. And by the middle of March, it seemed to me that it was quite a serious situation. So I was willing to be a team player and go along with whatever it was. One of the concerns that I had at that point, and I made quite a lot of noise about, was that we were being told that around 20% of cases would end up with needing hospital care. But they were also telling us at the time that we were going to have some 40 million people potentially infected, 66%, 60%, and maybe as high as 80% of the population infected. Well, 20% of 40 million is 8 million hospital cases. There are 170,000 NHS beds. That was never going to go. So if we were really going to end up with 8 million people needing hospital care, there was no way that the NHS was going to be able to cope. It was going to be swamped. So I was, I'd been pressing that point for some weeks. That doesn't mean that I was advocating a lockdown, because I was saying, well, shouldn't we have some means of looking after people in their own homes, or some advice for them on how to do that? But it seemed to me that it was legitimate to try to take the peak off it by having perhaps a 3-week lockdown, just to make sure you didn't get totally overwhelmed. And I think that there's a decent chance that they would have been totally overwhelmed, even with some moderation of behaviour. We still ended up at, 80% of the ICU capacity and so on used. If they'd waited another week or another fortnight, I think there is a pretty good chance that we would have had some pretty grim scenes of hospital capacity being tested. That's a very different proposition from the idea that you then say, well, because we have a temporary lockdown for a short period to achieve that objective, we're therefore buying into the idea that we're trying to suppress this disease on a long-term basis. And I always said that I thought that that was just a terrible idea. So those seem to me to be two very distinct concepts. Whether you have a short-term lockdown tactically in order to take the peak off the demand for the NHS is quite a different thing from saying we're going to attempt on a long-term basis to avoid this disease proceeding through our society. And at the kinds of infection fatality rates which they were talking about at the time, of the order of 0.8% as the infection fatality rate, that it seemed to me like the number of deaths, though highly regrettable, were not such as we could justify completely transforming our society on a long-term basis. So that to me, I feel like it was probably a legitimate thing to do, to take the peak off. Even if with the benefit of hindsight, it looks maybe like if we'd done similar behaviour, if we'd relied on people moderating their behaviour for themselves more the way that they did in Sweden, it might have been that that would have worked. We weren't sure at the time. And if you do only a short-term lockdown, it probably doesn't actually make a huge amount of difference to exactly what behaviours you create, you inculcate by doing that. We would have behaved a certain way, the Swedes behaved a certain way. I don't think that would have made a huge difference. The mistake wasn't having the lockdown. The mistake was deciding that you then switch from having a short-term lockdown to attempting to suppress the virus on a long-term basis with no real exit strategy from doing that. They're not saying, well, we're going to hang around for a vaccine for 6 months or 9 months, and if that doesn't work, we'll try something else or something like that. They're just saying, well, we're going to hang around, limiting the spread for as long as it takes. And that might be forever. And that's not a strategy. It seems to me like at some point, perhaps when Boris Johnson was sick, the whole government strategy collapsed and they haven't ever really recovered from that point.
It's funny because my second question was going to be, how's your thinking changed? But, you know, your answer there kind of shows me that it kind of hasn't. And it's really the government who've changed. And, you know, it's something that many people have brought up, even on this podcast, is that, you know, we supposedly had years and years worth of pandemic planning. And yet when it finally happens, they're making it up on the hoof. And, you know, as I think the quarantine issue is showing, almost just responding to public opinion. So on that issue, the quarantine is one of the measures that's being brought in that are being called the quote unquote new normal, which essentially means sustained social distancing, compulsory masks, and the, I suppose, banning of certain activities that we used to take for granted. What do you think of the sustained new normal distancing? And do you think its advocates have actually thought out what it would mean to its logical conclusion?
I think it's clear that they haven't thought it out to its logical conclusion. I also think that they have tended to very significantly underestimate what was required. So I think that they imagine, if all we were talking about was something like, we wear some masks on the tube and we avoid shaking hands, and maybe as we walk down the streets, we tend to stay a little bit further away from people in the past than we did in the past. All of those things would be more than tolerable. I mean, I know people might argue either way as to how necessary they were, but that would be a tolerable set of things to do. The reality, though, appears to be that this disease is so highly infectious that the things you need to do in order to really restrict its transmission are massively more extensive than that. You're talking about having very large portions of the population working from home. You're talking about abandoning almost all convivial gatherings. So you're not having any nightclubs or dancing together, or you don't hang out and meet any strangers outside your household or one or two other households that you create cell groups with. No more churches, no more choirs, no more football crowds, no more clapping and the orchestra, no more going to a school play, no more school rugby, all those kinds of things. And we're talking about an absolutely enormous change in our whole society. And one of the points that I raise with people is, suppose that you thought about it in the opposite direction. Many countries have higher fatality rates, mortality rates each year than we do. Or even in the UK, yes. If you went back 15, 20 years, our fatality rates were rather higher than they are today, equivalent to more than 100,000 extra people dying each year. If you had gone back to, say, the mid-1990s and you had said, and I think it's plausible that it might have been true, if the government had said, well, we've done a study and we've worked out that because of all of the various ways that disease is transmitted and the ways that people get into fights when they go out and drunkenness and things like that, we're going to ban all convivial gathering from now on. And we estimate that that will save an extra 100,000 lives per year. I don't think people would have said, at the time, I mean, perhaps a few people would have said, well, obviously we have to do that. I imagine most of the people would have said that this was the kind of lunatic authoritarianism that only the sort of dictators who erect 80-foot statues of themselves and name months of the year after their mother-in-law would ever propose. The kind of concepts which are involved, the level of authoritarianism which is really required here, the change in our society, is of an order which is not proportionate to what's being done. And that's not because the deaths involved are small. It's not that I've ever thought that we're only really talking about 10, 20,000 people dying. I think we're talking about more than 100,000 people dying, even if we had some excellent strategy for getting ourselves through this. The point is, it's an ugly truth to say, but the point is that saving 100,000 people, or even saving 100,000 people every year, is not enough to to justify this level of change in our society. And I think that people that I remember things. So back in March, I was saying, well, if you're going to go for suppression, when people were getting very upset about the allegation of herd immunity, and they're all saying the government was murderers and that kind of thing. I said, well, yes, suppression will mean that you don't get to have sex with people outside your household. So you better be thinking about having some kind of arranged marriages or something of that sort in the future, if you're gonna have, because this the only way that you're gonna be able to have sex with anybody new is if you establish a new household with them from scratch, without ever getting together with them beforehand. Now, people at the time thought that was very, disproportionate and very amusing. But of course, subsequently, we have all of this, lockdown sex, people getting obsessed about that.
Sex.
And now literally they passed a law which says you're not allowed to have sex with somebody from outside your household. That's what we've come to. That and my point is that was always what was going to be required, those kinds of things. And I think that we see, even from, there was some data released today, which shows that even the very modest changes that there were, the extra things that we were allowed to do from mid-May onwards, has led to a rise in the reproduction rate back to now, so that there are some regions where it's above one already. And I think that people were very unrealistic about the things which were being, which would be required. We were never talking about a few weeks and then everything would be okay. We were talking about the concept of changing our society on a very long-term basis. Another thing is, I think that people suddenly people have got very tech optimistic. People talked about, when there was things like the Brexit discussions and people said, there was this and that thing that could be used to deal with the Irish border. Then people got all very wild and saying, the magical thinking and what are all these strange technical solutions. And yet somehow they imagine that technology within a scale of 3 or 4 months is going to be able to solve a problem for us with convincingly addressing a coronavirus when there's never been a vaccine for a coronavirus, never been a successful vaccine for a coronavirus, and also therapies of some kind of cure for this thing, when these sorts of respiratory diseases have killed particularly old people all through the centuries and we've never come up with a convincing cure for them. So it might be that we do. I mean, I hope we do come up with some kind of solution. I don't think you or I will be taking any vaccines that haven't been tested quickly. But
no way.
But at the kind of fatality rates we're talking about for the old people, maybe a rushed through half botched job vaccine is worth taking from September, when, according to the latest data today, and I guess we'll come on to debating some of this in a minute, but the Public Health England data today says 23% of over 75s who get this disease will die. 23%. If you've got a 23% chance of dying if you get it, I think you're going to take almost any vaccine versus that kind of risk. So it might be that they come up with something which helps to mitigate the issues for the most vulnerable groups. But I think that we have to be sceptical about this. And what the advice that we've been given is that it's at least years. And I want to think, we're talking the impositions which you're talking about on young people. My teenage boys have absolutely zero risk. And we're talking about way less than a 1 in 10,000 risk of dying of this disease. And if you started thinking that 1 in 10,000 risks of dying of things, you'd never get on any train or plane or anything of that sort. 1 in 10,000 risks of dying, much less, in fact, for them, are not things which can justify for them changing their lives. So they are making sacrifices to help another set of people, old people. But I don't know any, the old people who are relatives of mine and old people I know would never ask that young people should never play football again or never go dancing again or never date a girl or anything like that, just to save them when they were really quite old. That's not that, I mean, one should make some sacrifices. We can't just, I don't think that we can just say, well, we'll take the risk. I mean, if the data's right and there's 23% of old people going to die if they get this disease, we should be prepared to make quite large sacrifices to try to avoid that. But there is a limit in the end. And it can't be that we completely transform our society on a long-term basis. And the government doesn't seem to want to engage with any kind of limitation on its plans. No trade-offs, nothing. It's the analysis is completely lacking as to what would actually constitute a strategy. I guess we'll talk about that more in due course as well.
Well, this is exactly why I wanted you on, and it's why Sir Dan of CNI gave you the Robust Principles Prize in the last podcast, even though it was a very tongue-in-cheek podcast. This one's a little bit more serious, but it's because the lockdown skeptics I interview and engage with all the time, overwhelmingly the point of view is that this will not run rampant and kill, 100,000 plus people. There's lots of different arguments as to why that might be. But one of the things that I think is most profound about what you're arguing is you're saying, even if that is the case, it is not worth locking down. And to give an analogy I've made before, if we go back to the Hong Kong flu of 68, 69, now, I asked my mum, who was 18 at the time, do you remember the Hong Kong flu? No idea. Not a clue. Did not remember it one bit. And thinking about that year, the things that we would have lost, right? Abbey Road, the first Woodstock, the first glass, the Apollo program, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. You know, this amazing cultural moment in the Western world, at least. The first episode of Sesame Street, all of that would have been gone.
Moon landing.
If we'd approached the same way. The moon landing. I mean, or to be fair, SpaceX have just gone up a few days ago, so I'm not sure. Maybe they would have found a way around it for that. But the point still remains that the opportunity cost, as an economist, you know exactly what opportunity cost is all about. And it's almost a life cost that we will not be getting back. And I've just become a father as well, and my boy is 5 months old, and the idea of him not interacting with another child for the first 2 or 3 years of his life is horrible to me. It's really upsetting. I want to ask you something else, actually. In the way that it's being justified, in your analogy of, say, went back in time to 1996 and said, look, we could save 100,000 lives by banning mass gatherings. The way that is explained to me, you'd kind of think that the people would say, oh, that's because you're partaking in those mass gatherings, you will take that risk. But the way that it seems to be justified amongst the public is on the argument of chains of transmission. So it's not you necessarily who might be taking a risk, is that they're not allowing people to take risks on behalf of other people.
Absolutely.
So when we mention the older people who, my parents are the same. They don't want to lock down on behalf of, which would inhibit my son's life chances. But I'm not sure it's being driven by that demographic. Especially people with grandchildren, I think a lot of older people take a much more philosophical view about this, as exactly you alluded to. So with that, what level of new normal do you think is acceptable? Especially, you actually caused a bit of a Twitter fuss today by saying you would accept masks, for instance, on public transport. Now I've been in Germany for 2 weeks where masks are compulsory in shops, and I hate it. And the idea upsets me of having them compulsory here. But let me take your reasoning why, as lockdown skeptics, which I think you are, why we should be prepared to accept these kind of some impositions.
Well, I'd want to distinguish between a couple of things. So I think that some people that object to almost any restriction are herd immunity advocates. So what they want to happen is for the disease to get through the society as quickly as possible. And really any kind of restriction that limits that, except maybe at some point at which you thought there was some threat to health capacity or something. Really, any restriction that that limits that is just dragging this out and making things worse over the longer run. So that may be a point of view, and if that were the point being made, I might have some sympathy with it. I think that we should have probably it would be worth waiting a short time to see whether some of the cures, probably, or maybe some of the vaccines, but waiting a short time to see whether there's something that turns up that dramatically reduces the fatality rate for the vulnerable group. And if we can't do that after some pre-committed short time, then we switch to what I call a shielded herd immunity strategy. I can explain that to you. Well, maybe I'll explain it to you straight away. So,
could you please explain?
So the idea of a shielded herd immunity strategy would be we would split society into two groups. So we would have a thing I call the bubble, and then you would have the rest. And in the bubble, you would have all the vulnerable, the old people, the people with cancers and other kind, you know, diabetes and other kinds of at-risk conditions. You might also allow at least a reasonable number of people who just didn't want to be in the other group to volunteer to go into the bubble, even if they weren't demonstrably at risk. And then the bubble group of people would have very strict protocols that kept them apart from the rest of society. So you would be able to enter the bubble and interact with other bubble people, but bubble people couldn't interact with other people unless they went through quarantines and other kinds of procedures. You would have other things such as cars transporting bubble group people would have priority, so other people would have to move out of the way and when they were being transported. In that group, you would also have to have people who volunteered to act as carers or medics or things like that. And you would have fairly complicated processes of going in and out between the bubble and the rest. The rest would then seek to, because they would be the people who would have very, very tiny risk for that group. So they would seek actively to act as normally as possible. Maybe they'd even actively, maybe you might even consider possibilities like some people deliberately contracting the disease if you didn't get enough spread. That might probably wouldn't be necessary. It's probably infectious enough not to need to do that. So you behave normally. The disease goes through that group. And then you've got enough people infected that they then achieve a herd immunity, a protection buffer, which then allows you to slowly but slowly reintegrate the people who are in the bubble into the wider group. There would be deaths under this strategy. There might certainly be thousands of deaths. There might be tens of thousands of deaths under that strategy. But it would allow you to reach a point at which society was normalized without you having without either probably having the 250,000 odd deaths or whatever the number is that you think it might be more, might be less than that, associated with a natural spread of the virus, or having society changed irrevocably over a long-term basis. There would still be some changes, but that would be that. Now, even when you had that, there's a chance that coronavirus would for some years circulate as a normal part of our society. When we've had these diseases in the past, things like the Russian flu or Spanish flu or whatever, eventually, Hong Kong flu is still around. People still get that. People still get the Russian flu.
Spanish flu is still around.
Yeah, so these things circulate, but over time they moderate. So you would expect that after 5 years, 10 years, whatever the exact number is, they would become much less lethal as they passed through. But there would be a period until that became much less lethal where we'd probably have to moderate our behaviour even after a shielded herd immunity strategy had been implemented. So, and for those few years, maybe we would do sensible things like wearing masks or on public transport, or maybe not shaking hands with older people when you met them. Things that there's elements which are common sense and moderate restrictions. They may not work completely, but as much as anything else, they signal to us the importance of hand washing and various other kinds of behaviours. If we do things like wear a mask, then we're acknowledging that we're in a scenario when we present a risk to others. And even if they don't, they may produce some, I suspect they do have some effect on your ability to transmit to other people. But they also signal a kind of politeness that I'm a person who takes a generally responsible approach. I wash my hands. I make sure that I don't go too close to old people if I can, that sort of thing. So I would have thought that those moderate disciplines, it would be much better to be willing to subject ourselves to very moderate disciplines and then get to a situation where we could play rugby and go to the pub and sing in choirs and all the other things we like to do, than to be so unwilling to compromise at all, that we created a situation in which a large group of people were continuously pressing against the boundary of the rules, creating a transmission rate which was just a bit too high, so that the authorities were never comfortable enough to let us behave more normally. So I suspect, alas, the way that it's going to work is that we're going to have that kind of society where quite a lot of people they want to press against the limit of the rules. So the spread's always just a little bit too high for the government to be comfortable. So it's always restricting us quite a bit. It would be better to be more disciplined, let the numbers get down, be willing to do a small number of things and have more normalisation, I think. I think it's counterproductive to be just completely rejecting everything. Sorry, that was a very long answer, but hopefully you get the idea.
No, it was a very good answer. And it brings me to a counterpoint. Which would be, what do you make of the argument that if we were to retain mask wearing? Now, I believe that the government have done this primarily because they're worried about pictures circulating the newspapers and social media of crowded tube carriages and people saying, why are we going back to work? It's clearly dangerous. Look how crowded this tube is. As a regular, I try and cycle as much as I can, but I'm a regular user of Central Line, and I just it's impossible to socially distance on that. But what do you make of the argument that by retaining things like masks, you retain a kind of pandemic mindset that will persist long after the threat has receded, and that will also prevent certain other activities from being opened up? I'm talking convivial gatherings, etc.
I'm not sure I really buy that. I mean, I get the idea. So what you're saying is something like, if you say, well, you wear masks on the tube, then what that does is encourage a political climate where people, because one of the features that we have at the moment is people were probably, I mean, they were right to be, I think, to want to restrict the spread, but people are probably quite paranoid about the risk to themselves personally. And you get a lot of this, you know, as you probably encountered on social media, people, as soon as you say any kind of thing, even I don't think I should be considered to be skeptical about standard. I'm always advertising what all the standard infection fatality rates and things like that are, but I'm always getting people coming and claiming that I'm far too optimistic. Far too optimistic, and far more people are going to be. It's far more dangerous than I'm suggesting. And I do think that there is. You're right that there's been a bit of paranoia. That's also combined with people finding it probably convenient to. Well, partly to criticise the government, but also you're playing into certain sort of atavistic fears of other people and things that you maybe didn't like travelling. And if you can find an excuse to not travel into town for work every day, then that's quite good. And so the concern, I do see it, is that you enable a political environment where people vote against these things. But my feeling is that the government just needs to be much more, it doesn't face any elections for a long time. Doesn't what the public thinks matters certainly very much at the level of compliance, but it doesn't face any political threat. It can do pretty much whatever it believes to be the right thing to do at this point. And I would say that it should seek a strategy which gets us to some kind of normalization as quickly as possible, rather than adopting a new norm. In fact, I would even have been sympathetic. I don't think it's feasible, but I would have been sympathetic if they had told us it could be done, to saying, well, let's just stay in full lockdown for an extra month or an extra 2 months and eradicate altogether domestically, New Zealand style. Yeah. If they'd really been able to, I never believed they could do that. But if they had been able to do that, that would be another way of bringing things to normality. Because, okay, it wouldn't be normal in that you couldn't travel internationally, but at least you'd be able to behave normally domestically. But they seem to me not to have any genuine strategy for getting us to any kind of normality. And I don't think that that's really because there's political pressure not to have such a strategy. I just think that they're bereft of some combination of moral courage and ideas of how to do it. They're lost, I think.
Well, if you read Katie Balls's piece in The Spectator today, she pointed out that even though the quarantining has no, it's very unpopular with a lot of backbenchers, Tory backbenchers, it's really doesn't have scientific basis. I don't think she wrote this, but apparently the sage weren't consulted really about it. But it's coming in anyway because there's 63% public support. I'm not sure who these 63% of people are. I'm sure they're out there, even amongst, you know, as I was pro-Brexit myself, I thought I had my finger on the pulse of the public more than most, but obviously not. And on that level, actually, I want to say something else. So because I'm currently in Germany, I can say this is a dispatch from your future. So I'm a month ahead of you. And so masks are compulsory in all shops. And for restaurants, they're open. The weather's been quite nice, so people are mostly outside anyway. But you can go inside and sit down. And there's this bizarre charade where you have to put your mask on to walk to your table. And as soon as you get to your table, then it comes off. Or if you want to go to the toilet, then you have to put it on again. And it's really odd. And the waiters have to wear masks, a lot of them wearing those kind of full-face visors, because I think you can breathe a bit better in those. But this kind of pushes back against the argument I put to you that I see less people in masks than I did in London. And I'm wondering if that is because of... Because they are compulsory, people kind of feel that they're protected. And so they feel that they don't have to wear them in their everyday life. Do you think that that would probably happen here? Do you think that might be what's going on?
I mean, I wouldn't have the same intuitions about Germany that you might. But my guess would be Germany has rather lower spread of the disease. There's probably fewer cases around. And I suspect that a lot of the things that we're, well, it's also, as well as lower spread, I think it's had quite a lot fewer deaths. So it probably has had a lower fatality rate relative to the spread. But I think that it's obvious that we've done deliberately too much, right? We've done more things, and that's partly because we didn't know what the right things to do were. So we've restricted our behavior in a vast range of ways. And at some point, there'll be a bit of a learning process of coming back from that and finding which things we can start to do more of again that don't create a problem. Now, it could be that if you have enough people who wear masks at the critical points, that then makes people feel free not to wear masks at other times. I suspect that some of the people we see who wear masks in the UK are doing so because they think it protects them. Really, insofar as a mask works at all, it probably mainly protects other people than the mask wearer.
Yes.
That's my suspicion. If you think you live in a disciplined society where people are required to wear masks enough that that then restricts the transmission through the disciplines, you then won't think you need to protect yourself by wearing a mask just as you walk along the road. Masks are the least, I mean... if you had to choose between a world in which we didn't wear masks but had no pubs and no church and things like that, and a world in which we did wear masks but you could go to the pub, I'm taking the latter world 100 times out of 100.
Yeah, but then you have to wear the mask when you get your pint and then take it off. It's just the absurdity of it. But I get your point. Politics is, as we know, the art of the possible, and sort of maybe lockdown skeptic ideologues like myself, maybe we might have to compromise. Actually, you did mention fatality rates there, vis-a-vis the UK and Germany. Are you sceptical about some of the claimed infection fatality rates? And how low do you think they could plausibly be?
So I happen to study this quite a lot, because the infection fatality rates, because I've actually been doing some in my day job, modelling the progression of the pandemic, and I need to know something of what plausible ranges are for the fatality rates in order to do that. Now, I model it under various different people's assumptions about that, so it isn't quite that I claim to have my own particular, I mean, I haven't done any experiments or anything to tell me what they are, so it's a read of the literature. There's a couple of things that I would say about that. One is that there's some misleading things that people say. So normal flus have an infection fatality rate of about 0.02 to 0.05. So between 1 in 200 and 1 in 500. You often hear that it's something like 0.1 or 0.2. It's not really that. So those are closer in concept to what we call the case fatality rate, which is the proportion of the people who present with symptoms who have it. But when you include all the asymptomatic cases and the people who have such mild cases that nobody ever notices, then actually the infection fatality rate for flus is quite a bit lower. And you need to compare apples with apples. The infection fatality rates, even on the optimistic stories for COVID-19, are of the order of 0.3%. Maybe a little bit lower. The CDC uses the US CDC uses fractionally lower numbers than that. And I know that Stanford had a number which was a little bit lower. Doesn't really work very well with the New York data in terms of the number of people who actually died. But so it's pretty implausible, I think, that it's lower than 0.2. But even that would be 10 times as bad as that kind of normal flu. And the numbers from PHE today are more than 2%, so more than 10 times as bad as that. So so we're talking about a disease which is a very, very nasty disease, a lot worse than a flu. Now, it might, if I had a skepticism, the place where I think some of the standard story breaks down isn't really the infection fatality rate. It seems likely to me, there seems to be an emerging consensus that it's of the order of 0.9% once you take account of differential attack rates. So that what that means is the older people you protect them and they don't tend to get it. They don't as much, right? Maybe only a quarter as much as the younger people get it. So even though it's very, very, very bad for them, fewer of them get it. So that drags down the average. The place where I think the stories of hundreds of thousands and so on dying might break down isn't there. It's actually to do with the level where behavior stabilizes the numbers who die. So what we call the herd immunity threshold. So all that herd immunity means is that the rate of transmission goes to one. So that's the definition of the herd immunity threshold, is when, given the number of susceptible people, given the infrastructure of society, you know, tubes and things like that, and given the way that we behave, how often we wipe our runny noses with our fingers and how often we wash our hands and whether we wear masks and all that kind of stuff, the behaviours, then the combination of those things leads to the rate of transmission being one, that and the intrinsic infectiousness of the disease. What standard epidemiological models assume is that the behaviors are either given or changed exogenously by something like a government diktat, a law, or the government urges everybody to start washing their hands or something like that. But more generally, that they're sort of fixed. It might be that people behave a certain way, but whatever it is, it doesn't respond to the levels of infection and deaths. Now, and that's a curious thing, I think, because as an economist, I mean, people used to do economic models where behavior didn't change, you know, back in sort of 1950 or something. For decades and decades, economists had realized that if you do models where you just assume that behavior is invariant, and even when people have incentives to change their behavior, and it doesn't get much better an incentive than I'll die or my gran will die, right? Those are pretty powerful incentives for me to moderate my behavior. If you don't take account of the way behavior adapts, your model's going to go completely kaput. And what happens, if it's actually quite feasible to introduce these kinds of incentives into the models. So you get the behavior reacts to the level of infection and the level of death in society. And when you do that, the herd immunity thresholds are way lower, right? So the proportions of, instead of it being 60 or 80% of people that you that you need to be infected, you find that it's more like 10 or 12% of people need to be infected, and you can, and then the behavior automatically changes. But sadly, four questions, and maybe this is my attitude that's connected with my point about things like the masks. The disease, unlike when you go through the vast majority of society, sometimes they overshoot so much that the diseases die out altogether in those kinds of models. But even if they don't, most people have had it. When you have this automatically moderating behavior, most people haven't had it. And what happens is the transmission rate sits at one, and then it sits quite stably at one, going a little bit above and a little bit down, for a very long time. So you end up with not any new normal which is imposed on you by the law, but just people's natural behavior creates a new society in which it takes a very long time before this normal transmission, natural transmission, gets enough people infected that you stop worrying about it at all. In fact, probably what would happen is you'd be waiting for the virus itself to change. So we were talking earlier about the 5 years or the 10 years or whatever before the virus itself changes through selection or mutation so that it's less deadly. That's what they tend to do over time. So one thing about that, so that might mean that you could, that doesn't mean that there's not going to be a problem, but it does mean that you could, as it were, marshal private resources and incentives more. They don't, the insight that people have powerful incentives themselves to moderate their behavior in such a way that things stabilize without the government needing to tell them is a more powerful force, I think, than has been recognized. And I think that that's probably quite a lot of what's going on, in particular with Sweden. So I would say that the Swedish numbers don't really tell us that the infection fatality rate is dramatically lower. In fact, the Swedish government themselves are now estimating about 0.6 for their fatality rate. Right. What it really tells us, I think, is that when you let people behave for themselves, they will moderate their own behavior so that you end up with things stabilizing. That's the thing which I would say, unless you're going to take an active strategy, your two alternatives, I would say, are to get through this thing in a kind of happier way than imposing long-term social distancing by law, would be a deliberate strategy. Well, obviously, the nicest thing is if we can get a cure or a vaccine in the next couple of months. But if you can't do that, right, then you could have a deliberate strategy of the shielded herd immunity strategy with the bubbles that I described before, or letting people's own incentives, because you're not going to want your grand to die. Right, so you will moderate your behavior so as to try to avoid your gran dying. And people will do that for themselves without the government needing to tell them because they care about their gran.
What do you make of the claim then that there might be a significant amount of latent immunity in the population? So to back up that point, I would say, from my own experience, that when I was in London up until about 2 weeks ago, more and more, people I knew, my friends, were out, yeah, existing, living as we were, going around people's houses. That's where transmission happens, right, mostly? I mean, that's kind of indisputable. And more, that's been what's going on. And yet, within that time, the infections within London have been going way down. And in East London, where I live, walking along the canal through Hackney Wick, oh my word, you know, you wouldn't think it was any different from a normal Saturday.
Now, well, a normal Saturday, that's kind of interesting. Just as a little aside on this point of the Saturday, one interesting thing is when you look at the and it's an under-remarked point. When you look at the data for around the peak, there are we have two little peaks in the data. So there's an April the 8th date and an April the 11th date. And if you do the maths of how there was a... it's a point I keep having to shoot down when people keep saying, oh, well, the average days from infection to death is 23. So that means that if the peak was at April the 8th, then the peak of infections must have been March the 17th or March the 16th. So it was several days before. That's not right. That's just mathematically not how it works. The way that it works, because if you can imagine, what happens is that when you're that you have a spread around the number of four, if you had your 23, just take that. Suppose that it's true that the average person dies 23 days after they get infected. But that's not everybody dies exactly 23 days. Some die at 22 and some die at 24, and there's a spread around them. When you're having a curve going up and there's a very rapid rise, what happens is that because it's accelerating more and more and more, of the deaths that are occurring, a higher and higher proportion are people who are dying a little bit earlier than the 23, rather than a little bit later. You're just capturing the effect of the of that spread, because as things are accelerating exponentially, you're getting more and more of the people who are just dying a bit sooner in the set. And they're being a higher proportion than the people who are dying a bit later who got sick earlier, because there are just fewer of them. And what this means is that you actually mean, instead of the gap mathematically being about 23, it's actually about 18 or 19 days difference. And it's pretty clear that the April the 8th peak of deaths is the March 20th, the Friday. That was when they... And then the April the 11th date, which is the second peak in the around the peak number of deaths, is the Monday infections. And there's two things about that. One is it tells us that actually probably the banning of the pubs and the gyms and things like that probably had more effect than the final lockdown telling everybody, partly because so many people by the Friday were already electing themselves to work from home and so on. But the second thing, which I think is the under-discussed point, is you get this big drop in the number of deaths on April the 9th and 10th. And it's much more than the normal volatility between days within the week of the number of deaths. And what that tells me is that at the weekend, natural behavior is such that even without a lockdown, the things which people did at that weekend did not transmit the disease very fast. Right. And so what the disease appears to be being appeared to be being transmitted much faster on weekdays when we're going off and using public transport and meeting at work and doing whatever we do after work and our weekday habits than our normal Sunday afternoon or Saturday kind of things that we do. And that seems to me to be an under-discussed, I think that's pretty clear from the data, that there's a big weekend effect on transmission, probably enough to take the transmission rate maybe even below one without any of the other restrictions. And so maybe you might say, well, the restrictions I want, really ideally, are the restrictions which make society behave like it would on a normal Saturday or Sunday. That should be enough. I don't need to ban everything. I just need to get to that. And if I can get to that, then I can get my R below one, even without much more. But so that was kind of that was a bit of an aside. But you were saying that so to help the viewers or listeners again, because it's too you to ask me your question again and then I'll answer.
So it basically my question was that there's more and more evidence coming out that there could be latent immunity within the population. That could be T cell immunity. Yep. That could be immunity from other coronaviruses. And you've been modelling this. So could be factored? Yeah, what do you make of it? Exactly?
Now, it's not a question. So two things to say about that. One is that I haven't done the kind of modelling like Carl Friston or somebody like that, where you see whether you get a better result if you assume a number of immune people than not, that kind of thing. But... Mm-hmm. I can tell you that the behavior of the infections and in the London area looks like the level of London exposure has been enough to make a material dent itself in the R. So you might get a bit of an effect on the R if your herd immunity threshold were 60%, but not that big an effect. So my feeling is that that might be partly because the behavior itself. So your herd immunity threshold, as I was saying near the start, depends on the behavior. So some combination of the natural behaviors that people would have even outside lockdown has taken the herd immunity threshold for London down a lot. But it could be other things. Maybe it's, you know, people say, oh, well, kids can get it, but they don't transmit it at the same rate as other people. Or you don't get the same infectious load from a person who's old as a person who's young. Or maybe it's higher from a person who's old than young, whichever way around it is. Other people say, well, some people have cross immunity from other viruses. They've either had other coronaviruses, or some people are just naturally immune for whatever reason. Maybe their own T cells have the right chemistry so that they pick it out and get it. And I did think that this business, I remember raising the thought of people having natural immunity in the middle of March. I don't know why people found that such a mysterious idea. Most diseases, there are some people who are naturally immune too. So I don't think it's an extravagant assumption that you would have a reasonable share of people who might be naturally immune. Maybe until you've got some evidence that you have some, it's prudent not to assume that. But I don't think we would think that that was some weird and miraculous feature of the coronavirus. Most diseases have people who at least have some resistance or immunity to them. My suspicion is that the right thing probably to guess, it might not be the right thing to base public policy on, but if you were just sort of guessing, the right assumption is probably that there's a chunk of people who have some kind of immunity. We don't know. Some people, and when people have gone and tested, it looks like there may be 40 to 60% of people who get some cross immunity from one or more of the other common coronaviruses. And so that's what the studies are saying at the moment. There may be other forms of immunity, which may include some of them and other things like people's natural T killer cells take the thing out just because of the chemistry of them, whatever it might be. So there's going to be a fair chunk of people who are naturally immune to this. And that will, again, probably take down the herd immunity thresholds. So that in the same way as the behavior, that's the space where I feel like the skepticism debate sits. I'm less skeptical than other people about the infection fatality rates. I think the infection fatality rate's pretty ugly. And the only question is whether it's like really ugly or really, really, really ugly. But if you're going to think that you're not going to get as many deaths, that would be because some people are immune, some people are resistant, and people's behavior changes so as to take the herd immunity thresholds way down. And it wouldn't surprise me from my models if London was already pretty close. So if in London you were to suppose maybe the herd immunity threshold with moderated change behavior might sit at 25% or something, and so if we've already got 17% of people who are infected as per the UK serology the antibody test data, that might mean 25%. We might need a bit more. We might not be quite there yet, but I suspect that in my numbers, it looks like we're not terribly far from herd immunity for London. Other places, a long way.
So that brings me on to something, actually, because you've spoken a bit about your modelling, which I believe you did for the National Association of Funeral Directors.
Correct.
And the modelling that you posited there, firstly, it'd be interesting to see what you found and then what was your methodology. But secondly, after having read it, or read the summary rather, it predicted significant regional second peaks.
Yeah.
Now, do you believe the so-called second waves of infection are inevitable? And obviously you do, because you stand by your own work. But so in that case, why do you believe that second waves like to happen? And is in general, are we to expect a second wave? There's an argument that we could already be in the second wave, you know, if this entered Europe back in December.
So how did the models work? The models worked in the following way. We have regional deaths data, And we, using infection fatality rates, we then back engineered what the implied level of infections were, given the maths at a certain date. And so you then get your epidemic going with a set of, it's a relatively short period, it's about a month of deaths data. From those deaths, you then, and you've got your epidemic proceeding, we also have data on the R naught, and then the R's later, but in particular the R naught estimates. And we use the Public Health England estimates. Initially, we used the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine estimates. We use the Public Health England estimates for England, and then the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine estimates for Wales, Scotland, and Northern Ireland. And those give us the initial figures. Then we calibrate the change in the R over time, using some assumptions about the change in shielding. So we have that the infection fatality rate drops a bit when, as you start to shield the elderly after the from 12th through to the 20th of March. So the fatality rate associated, because you've got different people being infected after that point. And also you have, you then use a combination of that and the other points which you have in your data, you then calibrate so as to match the pattern of the deaths. You've got enough fixed points that you can get a reasonable match. It's not a perfect match, but you get a reasonable fit to the data. And that gives you what your R naught is just prior to the lockdown. We then have the Public Health England estimates for what the R naught's been in lockdown. So we then have how the transmission, we use their estimates by region for how it proceeds after lockdown to get us to figures now. And we tweak each of these things a little bit to take account of more recent things like when the serology data came out, so as to get the a better fit to the regional antibodies data. But then you've got the question, well, suppose that you lift lockdown, what will happen then? What happens then is that you get we've got the behavior, we've got the R in lockdown, and we've got the R just before lockdown, which we worked out from the calibration process. And I then assume as a kind of base case that the post-lockdown R sits halfway between, right? So when you release lockdown, if you didn't do anything else, then you would be halfway between the natural social distancing behavior and the social distancing. So you go back halfway to what you were doing before. But then I say, well, suppose that we did that for the whole of England, what would be the transmission rate? And then that happens to go to, in some models, 1.5, in others, 1.7. So I then assume that the government would impose additional restrictions if they were successful, that then kept the R in the lockdown release, that kept the R to 1. So each region then gets scaled so that the national R then goes to 1. It's a little bit, I've gone into quite a bit of the gory detail of that, but what you're basically saying is I come up with an average and then I divide it by 1.5 because so that the national one works out as 1. And then if they're less successful, then it goes up to the 1.5 or whatever. So I have two sets of scenarios. I have where they're successful in keeping it to 1, and I have where they're unsuccessful when it goes up to this halfway between point. And one of the things is, if you can imagine that the national R being 1 is a composite, is a weighted combination of the R's in the different regions. So in some regions it's below 1, and in some regions it's above 1, if the national one is 1. In the regions where it's above 1, unless and until your level of infection is such that with that behavior associated with that R, you're at or above the herd immunity threshold in terms of the number of people infected, an R above 1 will mean spread. So that then drives these second peaks in the regions. So in the regions where people are behaving at that. And that's even more so in the scenarios where the government's less successful. So you then get a rise in various regions. Some, so you get both effects. So what happens is the national effect can be kept at one, and then you get a rise in some regions. In particular, you get a rise in northeastern Yorkshire and in Scotland and some models in Wales, even if the national pattern is successful. On the other hand, even if the national pattern is unsuccessful, there are regions where you don't get a second peak. And in particular, that's what happens in London. So in London, in the models, you've got enough people who are infected, who are already infected, that you get very little movement in the London infection rate, even if the national spread goes to 1.5 or 1.7, because there's so many people who've already had it in London that it just never gets going properly again. That's a little bit. It's not that you don't get any, but you really don't get into a second peak at all. And this kind of region, when we were first doing this regional stuff about a month ago, I think there was very little discussion of the regional aspect of this. But that now seems to me to become all the rage over the past month or so. Everybody's studying the regional, and people have got very alive to the idea maybe we need to have regionally different lockdowns, different strategies in different places, and that kind of a thing. That's the way that the models work.
So the issue is that I think the point you were making is that the second waves are much more likely in the regions because it hasn't penetrated the way that it has in London, which, you know, to me actually sounds very much like a very strong argument against lockdowns, because essentially you, like King Canute, although we need a better analogy, because King Canute was demonstrating you could not do this, but the point that Boris made at the very beginning was that this is not about reducing overall deaths or infections, it's about flattening the curve, and you know, we can't do that. And that idea has changed. Now, when we come to certain countries which have become these champions of the pro-lockdown cause, I'm thinking New Zealand is the biggest one, Austria, there are a few others, where they've basically totally suppressed the virus, largely by shutting down their borders completely. Now, as anybody who's played Risk before knows, New Zealand is right at the end. It's really not plugged into the global economy the way that New York and London are. So it's much more feasible that you can shut down New Zealand to outsiders. Do you think that we're going to hit a point where New Zealand just has to open up and say, right, we're just going to have to take this? Because I can't see them shutting down their borders in perpetuity. And well, when that happens, will they get the same infections other people have been having?
My feeling is that it'll actually work out okay for New Zealand in that they will have less economic damage in the short term because they'll be able to open up their economy and society, and you know, people have fun and play their sports and drink at the pub and what have you. Although they're not that dependent on things which come in from outside on a time-dependent basis. They're already, as you say, quite a long way from anywhere, so that doesn't really work anyway. So I think that they appear to succeed in eradicating domestically. They'll open up their domestic economy. They will open up eventually, even if the rest of us don't find any vaccine or anything. I think there'll be two other things that will happen. We will improve our management of the disease for the elderly. Even if we don't find a proper cure, we'll find some things that help a little bit at the margin and take down the fatality rate, so we'll reduce the risk. Secondly, we'll get very good at testing people, so we're able to do lots of testing very fast. Also, there'll be techniques which are developed in the rest of the world for tracing cases and things like that very rapidly. And what will happen is that, furthermore, the disease itself will moderate after a few years. And my guess is that New Zealand will hang it out and they'll let the disease not be much of a threat, and then they'll open up again. And that might be 3 or 4 years that they're having to be isolated for everybody else. But if you think about the amount of damage which our lockdowns and so on have had for our societies, they're going to have a lot of problems associated with isolation for that to be as big a problem as the problems that we've had from lockdowns. You know, the things that we've done have, and even from countries that didn't lock down that much, they've had some quite bad hits. You know, like Sweden has had quite a bad hit to its economy, even without that much lockdown. So my feeling is the New Zealand, a small number of countries, New Zealand, Taiwan, Australia, they'll all do pretty well, provided that they can avoid cases coming in. There's, people haven't remarked on this point, by the way, that the people from Hong Kong who are presumably going to go and locate into the UK and Australia maybe, and Canada, you know, even if they have quite a lot of, presumably they'll be subject to quite a lot of quarantine, but there must be some extra risk if you suddenly have hundreds of thousands of people turning up from those places. So I think that'll be okay. Austria, it's very hard to see how anywhere in Europe could be properly insulated from other places. Containment, if containment had been possible, then we would have contained this disease back in February. I think it's very difficult to imagine how any of that can work. I think that all that you've really done is delay things. So they won't be able to keep things off indefinitely. Maybe some of these, depends how infectious it proves. I mean, the Koreans seem to be doing some things. Some of those things in East Asia are kind of interesting. My oldest boy lives in Japan.
All right.
And he says that that there's a common belief. It's not something which has made a lot of discussion in the press. He says that there's a common belief in Japan that part of the reason they've not had so many cases is because there was a cold which people got in Japan, which was much worse, Stephen says, than anything he'd encountered in Europe. But there was a common cold which people had, which had been around in Japan for the past 10 years or so. And the theory appears to be that maybe some variant of SARS back 15 years ago or whatever actually spread a bit more in East Asia than people think, and that it provides some sort of cross resistance or cross immunity, so that you don't get, if not immunity, then at least people, it's not the same as a disease which your immune system has no idea what to do with. So it might be that some, that actually when we, and my point about that is that you want to probably avoid learning too many false lessons from the success of some of these East Asian countries in managing this, because we may not have the same biological conditions that allow us to make the success, because we just have, it's going to spread faster for us because we probably have fewer people who have any kind of resistance than they do, or at least, you know, that's at least a possibility. I'm not saying it's I mean, I'm not qualified to say whether it's probable or not, but at least you should worry about that possibility. My feeling is
I agree very much.
We won't really be able to contain things. I don't think containment can work in the UK or anywhere in Europe. I think that all we're really doing with this stuff is waiting for some kind of second peak to overwhelm us as people start to behave a little bit more normally, and especially once you go through to things like the winter and people have to be inside more. So I think it's just going to come. And the question is, either you deliberately make it happen during the summer at some level where it's easier to cope with, or it comes and it gets you when we come to next winter. And you better hope that when it, I know we're waiting and we're thinking there's going to be a vaccine or a cure or whatever it is. Well, the blooming well better be. It's because you've missed your window of opportunity to control this thing and to make sure that people are properly shielded and stuff. So when it does come, you're not going to be able to play all of these cards twice. My suspicion is that it's going to come and get all European countries over the next 6 to 9 months, and they probably won't have. They may have better cures and disease management and things like that. Everybody's not going to be stuck on a ventilator straight away and those kinds of things this next time. So that'll work a bit better. My guess is we won't have a vaccine by then, but who knows? My only basis for saying that guess is what Chris Whitty and the other, that's just what the UK scientists tell us, that we shouldn't expect it to be for 18 months.
Well, I don't think, I'm very sceptical, because the Asian countries have been terrified for 17 years, SARS was, and there's a lot of pharmaceutical capacity there. And it's a common, it's a saying, isn't it? Trying to find the cause for the common cold. It's entered our idioms that it's as an impossibility. So I'm extremely skeptical that we'll find one. You know, where's the HIV vaccine? People have been looking for that very intensively. But there's something that I'd like to go into as well, because as an economist, I'm sure that you do not find a small level of irony in the fact that you had a lot thrown at you as being one of the pro-Brexit economists, right in the foxhole, really, as the, you know, the bullets were flying over your head, about these prophecies of doom that will come knocking off, you know, potentially half a percentile or 1 percentile of GDP, or the results of, you know, not having a trade deal. And yet, those very same people are now advocating measures that completely dwarf anything that could be feasible. And, you know, I think you have argued, I would certainly argue, that it's certainly not a it's not a dead cert that no deal Brexit would result in any reduction in GDP, to be honest with you. But taking that as our basis, where do you see the economic consequences of this being? So now we're very much in your home territory.
Yeah, so sure. Well, I think that there would be... It depends very much on how quickly matters are resolved, obviously. So if there were to be a therapy within a few months' time, then the damage is obviously much less than if it takes much longer. But even if you got some therapy quite quickly, I think that there will be, I do buy the story that we will see significant structural changes. I think that there'll be a lot more working from home in future. I think that there will be even perhaps more than the working from home, ordering from home. So I've got used to the idea in this. I bought some things online before, but now I just buy all kinds of stuff online. If I want a set of cuff links, I go and I click a couple of buttons and then it arrives the next day. But once upon a time, I'd have said, oh, well, I'll go and I'll get my cufflinks next time I'm at work or something. And it would take me a week or a fortnight to get around to it. And then I'd eventually... And then when I finally did get them, the only place I'd get them would be a store I'd see, and I'd go in and they'd be like 25 quid for one pair. Mm. Whereas now I click two buttons and I get six for 15 quid or something, right? And so they're much cheaper and it's much more accessible. Some things are more expensive, but the whole process is we've worked out how to do it online. And I think that that will cause an enormous shift in all kinds of purchasing. We're just much more used to doing that. And I think there'll be long-term consequences of that. I think that we have, there will be changes from in working patterns. I think there will be changes to public transport. I just find it unfathomable that they pressed ahead with the HS2 under these circumstances. Mm. I just think that was just really bizarre. I mean, HS2 was almost indefensible anyway, but the idea that you would think that a thing like this made no difference to the costs and benefits of a public transport scheme, I just don't understand that. Let's do a few other things that will change quite a lot.
Okay.
An area that people underestimate. So I'll go for two really big things which I think are under-discussed. One is commercial rents. So normally about 10% of commercial rents are behind. Currently it's over 40% of commercial rents are behind. And once the firms are functioning again, loads of those firms, if they immediately had to pay, then there's no way they'll just go bankrupt if they would have to pay. So there's a huge backlog. Furthermore, lots of firms will come and they will probably try to dispute. They'll claim that their leases were frustrated or that they can't pay for this and that reason. Or they'll say, we were charged for services implicitly in the contract, which we were never delivered, or whatever it might be. Now, as I understand it, I find it very peculiar if you think about it kind of from a natural justice point of view. the idea that the government would say to me, that as a firm, de facto, I'm not allowed to use my office, but my commercial landlord is shielded from all the consequences. So my commercial landlord is not allowed to provide me with my services as a firm, but the commercial landlord, I still have to pay him. I find that very weird as an idea. Now, and you would have thought, well, I guess many firms and so on will imagine that they're going to go back and then dispute this legally at some point. Apparently, I'm told there's some kind of, I don't know anything about this, but I'm told that there's some sort of legal precedent going back to the Civil War or something that says that even if the king garrisons royalist troops in your particular property and so you can't use it, you still have to pay the rent. As I understand it, there's some like old, very old principle that basically says it doesn't matter what the government policy was that prevented you from getting the service, you still have to pay the rent. So if there's going to be any kind of burden sharing here, you would have to pass a law. And I think one of the interesting things will be in the autumn or in the winter, I think there will be pressure for some kind of burden sharing law, because otherwise you're going to have years of the courts all gummed up with this enormous number of commercial rent disputes and on a huge, you know, hundreds of billions scale of money. So the pressure to resolve the question with some blanket law which shares things out rather than having everybody try to work it out amongst themselves would be quite high. And an interesting question is what sort of pro-market people should think about that. I don't think it's very obvious what a pro-market person ought to think on that question, whether they should be in favour of such a law or not. And so I think that's kind of an interesting, and I don't really know, again, I don't have a strong instinct as to whether where a Conservative versus a Labour person would sit on such a law. I think it's quite an interesting sort of cross, just not a question that people have really thought about very much. So I think that's one big thing. The second big thing, which I think is under discussed, is inflation. Because we're going to have, so the government, we're going to end up, I mean, lots of things. Obviously, you've got huge amounts of private debt accumulated in this period. We got a huge hit to GDP. We're going to have all kinds of adjustment of the price level as people buy a load of things which they didn't buy before, everybody having broadband in their house or whatever, and then not buying the things which they bought at the office. And so that's going to cause some big disruption in the basket of prices. That, of course, then means that normal inflation concepts, it's not very straightforward to say that they apply in the same way, because you're not comparing a basket of the same goods with the basket of the same goods later. You're comparing one set of goods with a different set. So why would it be wrong if the prices are different, whether if they go up or down or whatever? It's not so obvious that they're right or wrong then. But a second thing is, apart from that kind of point that it might be just a price level adjustment, a second thing is you've got all of this public debt. So the government's going to end up with like Italian levels of 120% debt to GDP or something by the time we're done here, maybe higher. I don't think there's going to be much appetite for spending cuts. There's no capacity or appetite for tax rises. So, and we're not going to grow. So I would have thought.
So what happens?
Yeah, well, you inflate it away is what you do. I mean, that's. Okay. And so I think there'll be inflation. And I think that we might see double digit inflation. It's not even obvious to me that it's the wrong answer. I think that that's the thing that's going to happen, is that we're going to get inflation and people are not really thinking through what that means. That's also, I mean, obviously at some level, that's like a wealth tax and an income tax, and it changes the relationship between past accumulated savings and future earnings and all kinds of, it disrupts all kinds of things. But maybe this is a scenario in which those things ought to be disrupted, those relationships. Maybe it's not a scenario that demands stability. It's a scenario that demands change in some way. So I think that those are things that are going to happen. I think that we will also see accelerated moves towards stuff like more automation. So we're going to see more automated tills in your retail outlets and less people going to them. We'll see more pressure for automated vehicles, automated tubes, trains, automated better working automated ticket machines on the tube and when you go through. And all those sorts of systems, I think there'll be more pressure for that. And probably there's some interesting interactions with green discussions, because people have assumed that things like public transport have less externalities because you have less carbon emissions and things like that per person. But of course, now we think of them, actually, they have there's a countervailing more set of externalities, because you infect people on the in public transport. And that might lead to a different, could lead to a new age of the car. People already driving more relative to public transport. Now, although there have been very few cars sold, I suspect that so car companies, some of them might even go bust. They'll take a hit, at least for now. But if you look out a little bit further ahead, I think we could see a big rise in uses of cars relative to other technologies. There are lots of other things to say as well, but those are just a few just to get you going.
What do you think of my theory, which I'm going to present to you, which is that a secondary reason for the incoming quarantine is to is a means of kickstarting the economy. And by that I mean the government are aware they've just spent billions of furlough money. They're going to try and keep that in the UK and perhaps even encourage people to go on staycations. I think Boris has even said, you know, that there's wonderful holidays you could have in the UK. And looking at Boris's record, which is sort of the Olympics is kind of part of that. There was talk of him having this UK bid for the UK-wide World Cup bid in order to shore up the union. This is kind of how he thinks, you know, this kind of shared national efforts. Do you think there's something in that?
My suspicion is that that's probably a bit sort of too clever by half, as it were, for the way that they, that's my feeling, my guess is that the business with the quarantine is a bit more straightforward than that. It's a combination of, they don't want to import extra cases because it's hard enough to manage the cases that we have. And they want there's some public pressure to be seen to do something. And since international travel has pretty much collapsed anyway, then if you just take the last few bits of it, that's relatively low cost way of being seen to do something extra. I think we probably will. You know, I think that they will seek to establish some travel bubbles with countries which have reasonably similar levels of infection. Whether the EU rules will let them do that, especially in a context in which we have a breakdown in relations with the EU. And what that means, you know, with the EU free trade agreement talks collapsing, which they seem to be on the point of doing, what does that mean for establishing travel bubbles with Portugal and France and Ireland, especially given that the EU didn't want us to do that in the first place? And what would that mean? I mean, will those countries, what does that mean for those countries' relationships with the EU? I mean, if the UK is willing to have to do it with Portugal, and Portugal's willing to do it with the UK, but the EU says that Portugal, you're not allowed to do it, it's not clear to me that the Portuguese, who the Portuguese side with, as it were, under those circumstances, so this could create a problem for the EU's internal unity. One thing, way to think about the business with linking up with countries with even levels of infection is, of course, if I link up with the French, then there's some chance that somebody comes in from France and infects a load of people here, and I find that hard to track. On the other hand, there is, in the opposite direction, a chance that somebody who would have infected a load of people here in the UK goes on holiday to France and infects people there instead. And so, provided you're interacting with countries where things are reasonably even, then you should expect those two kinds of effects to pretty much net out. If you were to have a travel bubble with Brazil, then you might worry more that what we do is to have a net importing of cases. Mm. It is also true that the process of travel probably increases transmission. So you go and you sit on a plane. I mean, I don't know, but the impression, the understanding, again, it's not my, I don't claim any medical knowledge, but common sense would suggest that since this appears to be a disease which transmits better inside, if you're sitting in a plane with people for hours, then you're probably going to end up transmitting it to more of those people than if you were wandering outside in the sunny fields in, you know, Devon or something. It's going to be a different, probably more likely the process of travel might make some difference to the transmission as well.
So, thanks so much for coming on the show today. it's been a really great conversation. We've kind of roamed everywhere. So I'd like to sort of end with a sort of slightly more philosophical question about what's it like sort of being a bit of an outlier? So obviously as a sort of figurehead of sort of Brexit economists or Brexit supporting economists, you've had a fair bit thrown at you. I asked you something on Twitter a few weeks ago, actually. I don't know if you remember, about having stuff thrown at you, because this topic is so emotive. And yet, as I said at the very beginning of this, I think you've in some way stuck with a very unpopular position, which is, it's not even sugarcoating it. It's not even saying, I think it should open up because it won't be that bad. You're saying, no, I think it will be pretty bad, but we should still open up. So do you ever have moments where you think, should I write this article? Or do you still come, does everything come from your place of, no, this is my analysis and I'm going to say it and I don't care?
Well, I guess that it's a lot of people who criticize things are who get very, I guess there are two sets of people that I think of who've tended to be quite negative about things that I've said over a number of years. And it's not, I guess I've been quite unpopular sometimes in some things about this. I was very unpopular about things on Brexit. Not only, I mean, I was unpopular even with Brexiteers when I was saying that we shouldn't be, we shouldn't accept Theresa May's deal. And then on the Brexit discussions earlier, where if you go back earlier in time than that, then all the austerity stuff when I was an advocate of that, or back earlier than that when I said the UK shouldn't join the Euro, there were people who were didn't like that either. One thing is that I'm kind of used to. I'm used to that kind of a thing. Well, I used to do more politics than that. I used to be a councillor and stand for elections and stuff like that. I used to give quite a lot of political speeches. I still do every now and then, but I used to give really quite political one in very when you were standing definitely as a Conservative. And kind of my specialty in those circumstances, I felt, was coming across a room where two-thirds of people disagreed with you and one-third of people agreed with you, and leaving a room where two-thirds of people agreed with you and one-third of people absolutely hated you. That was so. That seems to me to be, that's my kind of niche in life, is to... And it's partly because I tend not to like to give way on the grounds where people think, where my opponents think they already have the high moral position. So many people want to say things like, we agree that you're the good, that you've got the morally sound case, but mm-hmm. what I say is going to be necessary because of the economy or something like that. Whereas normally, whereas I tend to want to say, no, I'm the good guy, and so I don't accept your claim that, right? So, and people don't tend to like that, right? If you attack them, because they thought that they were safe on the grounds of them being the good guy. So again, if people say things like, in this current situation, some people want to say, I don't think that tens of thousands of people should die. And they expect that you to say something back to them like, well, no, but you got the science wrong and tens of thousands of people aren't going to die, or 100,000 people aren't going to die. Or they expect you to say something like, well, yeah, but we have to worry about the economy and it's just not feasible to save these people or whatever. What they don't want to hear is somebody coming along and saying, yeah, 100,000 people might die, but people being able to play in the sunshine and become actors and cuddle each other drink together and laugh and dance and sing. These are things which matter more than that, right? In the end of the day, they're things that matter too. And you can't say that they don't matter. And you might say they don't matter for 3 weeks, but they do matter for 2 years or 5 years or for forever. So when you disagree with people at what they think is their strong point, that's when they tend to dislike things the most. The other people who dislike you are sometimes the ones who want to argue the other type of case, right? Mm-hmm. The one like the economic necessity or something. Yeah. Because although they secretly agree with you, they don't think that that will win. And they think that you kind of inflame things by attacking people at the at that point, because they then think it's harder to sell them on the other argument. But I my feeling is, I feel like over the years there have been enough occasions on which everybody, I've found that there were enough occasions on which if you stood up and said the thing that you believed, it turned out that more people would side with you than you thought. And even if they don't side with you to start with, then after a bit, they come and realize that you were right. And although my feeling is you don't tend to get thanked for that very much. You particularly don't get thanked for being right early. So what people want you to do is to be right at the same time as everybody else. Whereas, and that's fine, because some people in life need to be the ones who are right early and then get hated for that by everybody.
So, oh, what a burden you carry, Andrew. Well, and with that, I just have a couple more. That was a really, it's quite inspiring in its way, actually, that little bit there. It makes you think that, you know, we need to approach these problems courageously. And I think one of the reasons that we're in this mess is that we haven't done so. One of my former guests, James Denningpole, called it the perfect storm of stupid. And I think it's a really good line, because we're not being honest with ourselves about what these things mean and what they mean for our lives. And what is life if we can't have weddings and dating and singing and sports and music and all these things? You know, what is life without Abbey Road and Woodstock and the moon landings and Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid? So on those wonderful cultural events, I have two little segments at the end to continue the prison theme of this podcast. So thank you very much for joining my escape party as we try to escape from lockdown. So what's your contraband? So this is the stuff that might not be, you know, completely within the rules, but the stuff that's been keeping you going, your non-essential activity that has really been grounding you during your lockdown.
Okay, so a couple of things. So I sing quite a lot. So I've had some singing lessons via the internet from somebody in America, which is quite fun.
Oh, great.
So I've been trying to do a bit more singing at home. I have, now that we're allowed, normally I would play squash and five-a-side football and various other things that one isn't allowed to do. but I've been having a go for the past few weeks at playing tennis, which I'm extremely bad at, which is strange for, normally I'm good at physical things quite quickly. Yeah. And it's quite strange for me to find something which I just can't serve. I can't serve the ball. It's really strange. The third thing which I've been doing, so I've been watching various TV shows, I guess. Those would be three things that would be examples.
Oh, so that comes into my watch list. So okay. This is the second one. On the surf, by the way, the trick is just do it as slow as anything. Just slowly bonk it in, and over time, you can do it a bit quicker. You don't need to be Andy Roddick straight away. On your watch list, what shows have you been sessioning which you can recommend to our listeners?
I watched The Rookie. I quite liked The Rookie. Which is on Sky Witness, I think. I thought that was quite fun.
So what's that about?
That's about a 45-year-old new policeman. So he has a career change in midlife.
Oh, right. Okay.
And so he's the oldest rookie on the force because he had a career change after his divorce. So I watched that one. I watched a bit of Hawaii Five-O. So I watched that a few times, quite liked that. I did make the mistake of watching Westworld, though I probably wouldn't recommend.
Oh,
that you did that.
Yeah, it's poor.
I watched 3%, which is, a Brazilian show on Netflix, which was kind of intriguing. It's
see, when you first watch it, it seems quite low budget, but it raises some interesting thoughts as you, it's quite fun as you go along, as you'll see the idea with 3%. In 3%, what they're doing is, there are people who are, when they get to a certain birthday, I think it's their 20th birthday or something, they then go through these series of trials, and 3% of them get selected to be, the ones who get through all the trials, get selected to be the elite who live on this island being kept in wealth, while the rest of the rest of society all lives in these sort of ghettos. So that's kind of
that sounds really good. Okay, well, listeners, you heard it here. 3%, that's going to be the one that I'm going to look for. So, Andrew, if anybody wants to read you, get in touch with you, tweet at you, where's the best place to do that?
Probably on Twitter. So I'm at Andrew_Lillico, Lillico. That would be the place to get me.
And once again, I'd like to congratulate you on in our last podcast awarding you the prize for the most robust principles. And I'd say on this performance, you most definitely deserve it. So thanks very much for coming on. Dear listener, please stay tuned. I've still got some excellent guests lined up. I'm going to keep doing this for as long as lockdown persists and onwards, because we're entering a state of paralysis almost. And I think the more we can keep discussing this, the more we spread these ideas, the faster we'll get out of this mess. So please stay tuned, don't let this shit get you down, and see you next time on Escape from Lockdown. Bye bye.